So artificial intelligence is a hot topic right now, what we are currently playing around with. And the question is, what kind of effects does it have on a society? And what does it mean to sustainability in society in this context? And why is AI not sustainable at the moment? Rainer can answer these questions. He's head of the Department of Social Dimensions of the Institute of Cognitive Sciences. He lives in Berlin and he's a researcher in this area. He will explain everything about AI, sustainability, and power, and big applause for Rainer. Thank you very much. Welcome at this late hour. Great to see you all. So AI creates inequality. I want to talk about the social impact of artificial intelligence. And we'll start, before the sound disappears again, a short TLDR. What I want to talk to you about is the image of artificial intelligence which is presented to us in the media looks a bit like this, the schema. The brain is somehow simulated by computational processes or replaced even. You can see this in different ways, in different formats. So there's this artificial intelligence which somehow imitates human intelligence. I believe, and this is what I want to say today, this image of AI is wrong. What AI is in reality is something like this. So when you look at it this way, you can say why this kind of AI is not is in conflict with the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations, the 17 SDGs. So let's get started. Back in the 2000s here, there was no talk about AI without him. This is Louis von Ahn. Back in the 2000 years, perhaps 2006, I believe, he wrote a dissertation in computer science about human computation. Here's a quote from a Google Tech Talk in 2006, at Google, invited by Google. And there are some quotes like this. The start of my dissertation was there were so many wasted human cycles every day. For example, 9 billion human hours of solitaire played in 2003. What a waste. His dissertation project was about considering the entire humanity as an extremely advanced large-scale distributed processing unit and to put an end to this waste. So he created this game, for instance, together with his colleague Laura Dabisch, the ESP game, which became quite a legend and was purchased later on by Google. So you're being put together with a different player and you have to enter keywords for an image which is shown to both players at the same time, and the more quickly you can enter the same keyword, you get points, and if some words are output as taboos. Nice way to label images, and this became the Google image labeler after purchase. Before that, the Google image search was only accessible by file name, and after this, the Google search was able to access the images by keywords. Louis von Ahn was also one of the inventors and first author of this paper, Capture. So all these old captures, those are security barriers. Using hard AR problems for security was the title of that paper. A few years later, he created this. This is a paper recapture. these security barriers are being used for. As everyone knows, we are still being confronted with these today. This was also sold to Google successfully. So just a flashback now, we move forward 10 years to the middle of the 2010s, and here's another person, Andrew Ng. He was touring with talks like AI is the new electricity from 2017. I quote from a very interesting talk where he says something like, look, we're in the 2010s, you can purchase computing power in the cloud. Talent is a problem, so workforce who are able to program this, but the greatest problem for AI-based business models is the lack of data. So whoever has the training data also has the AI. Everything depends on having the data. He puts forward this interesting prognosis, what is possible with AI, what we can expect that AI will be good at, looking forward from 2017. And he says, anything a typical human can do in less than 1 second of thought, we can probably now or soon automate with AI. What he's preaching to the students in Stanford, where this talk was presented, it basically means establishing a gigantic feedback loop, and it starts with a good product. This good product has to attract users, those users produce data, and with the more data you can create a better product, which attracts even more users. Those users, of course, produce more data again. The sound is gone, and he is continuing to talk now. So there's a large feedback loop, which has been created this way, if you do artificial intelligence according to Andrew Ng. So if we look at that decade, so we're in the 2010s, then we can also see that this is the decade of the great data collection projects. Facebook's has been around since 2006. So in the noughties, this is where the large data collection game started. ESP game was in 2003. Web 2.0 around 2004. Amazon Mechanical Turk, Google Analytics around 2005. Facebook in 2006. And if you look at this in this historically aggregated manner, then there's a global media infrastructure which was established for data collection. Basically, the establishment of connected media infrastructures for the production of AI training data. And with a latency of around 10 years, around 2016, the hype around deep learning took off. What I'm aiming at is that this was not a coincidence, but that you need to look at the history of artificial intelligence in a form of media infrastructure history. So what is being hyped today as AI? This is data-based AI, machine learning, and other methods which are using our data. The creation of this technology needs to be explained as a story of media. That's the proposition which I want to establish here.
And what results from that is that this AI that we're talking about right now, that's being hyped right now, and what we mean when we use the term AI, well, except for the futuristic stuff, that's not really there yet. When we want to do research on that and look at the ethical implications it brings with it, then we need to look at AI as a socio-technical system. Because these implications are a major part of these systems. And so one of the aspects of the ethical work that we do, that I do at Osnabrück, is human-aided AI. So this is a critical view of what happens in these AI systems today. And really, these successful AI systems today are cybernetic human-machine networks. And so people are an integral part of these systems. But why do we use the term cybernetic? That term relates to these feedback loops between people and machines. And so the best example for that is the Google search that we all know. If you click on a link here, I think everyone in this room knows that, you don't get where you think you're going. But first things first, you're going to Google, and Google collects some data, a lot of data, which you can easily reverse engineer and look at what they're collecting in detail. And then they forward you to, for example, tagesschau.de. And so, of course, there's more elaborate ways, but really it always comes down to this. And so this apparatus keeps collecting more and more training data through this like swarm approach that's being used here. And we're all part of it when we use Google search. And so this is really prototypical of AI today. It's always about designing feedback loops. It's not just about algorithms that run in a data center somewhere or trained models. It's really about intelligent design. So this is a special form of coding, right? It's a form of coding feedback loops. And so at some point at the end of the 2000s, Facebook introduced this face tagging feature. You could tag users on a photo uploaded to Facebook. And surely this was, you know, not done in a 100% benevolent spirit. And so what was this used for? Well, it's obviously was used for building a facial recognition AI. And they tried to keep it secret, but then it leaked. And then at some point, they sold it back to us as a privacy feature, because then if you're automatically like recognized on a photo that's being uploaded to Facebook, you got a notification like that, which told you, hey, a photo of you has been uploaded to Facebook. And then you can say, well, you know, just ignore me, don't tag me, or yes, tag me. And you can even say, like, click the three dot button and say, that's not me. And that's the design of a feedback loop, right? What's relevant to Facebook is the difference between left and right. It doesn't matter if you want to be tagged or don't want to be tagged. Both of those are saying, yes, that's me on the photo. But on the right side, if you say, hey, that's not me on the photo, that's an important datum that the system needs to know. And so this sort of AI apparatus, you know, we as users were an important part of that. And it's not just during the training, but like it was a continuous process, right? And so that leads to my second thesis this evening, this so-called principle of correspondence. So the design of feedback loops, so machine learning problems are being translated into UX design problems, because the design of these feedback loops, you know, the designers that come up with these feedback loops, they're a huge part, and they have to solve this UX problem, right? And they're a huge part of all of these large-scale AI systems. And one more example, and this is, you know, a bit tedious, because, but I hope you can follow me. So personalized advertisements. What's bad about like targeted advertisements, right? Well, the point is it's very harmful. So one example for a health product, and in that case it's a health study, for a diabetes type 2 study. And, you know, it's hard to find people willing to partake in a study as subjects, and it's hard to find the right people with the right conditions. But you can do that using social media, because you can like have spend the same budget, but really find the, you know, the specific people that you're looking for. At least that's like what Facebook tells you. And so we have to think about the life cycle of a social media campaign like that, and have a look at that. So you can sign up right then and there. So there you can just sign up as a participant for this diabetes type 2 study. And so let's look at the life cycle of a study like that. You want to post your ad, right? And you have a criteria for what sort of people you want to show your ad to. And so maybe like, you know, first world kind of people, age between X and Y, something like that. And that input, you know, you give that to the social media platform, and the targeting algorithm that they use selects the users accordingly, and then some of those users see the ad. So that's the promise that they give you. But of course, that's not the whole story, right? So for online advertisements, you know, it's inherent that you have to count the clicks, right? You wanna know the reach of your ad. Do people even look at that? Do they even see it? Do they click on it? And so you wanna look at the engagement data. And of course, that data is very interesting training data to like keep improving the feedback loop. And so they start with these like initial data input from the customer, but and then they look at like who even clicks on the ad, and then you know, during the first few days of the ad being posted, they keep improving and refining, and so more and more they find the people that really are going to click on that ad. And so what they train by doing that is a model that can predict this type of disease within their user base, now or in the future, because it probably correlates very well between people who click that button and people who actually have that disease. And so having created that model, you know, even if people only sign up for Facebook 5 years after that, or if they've, you know, already deleted their profile, but they still have the data lying around in the background somewhere, it still applies. And so this principle, this approach, the customer starting this process, the users, the platform, they all participate in this AI system that can predict this disease wherever, even in different platforms. And so, yeah, you can see how powerful, right, this system is. And so we have a few cases where social media platforms collaborated with different industries, for example, securities, companies that do like AI-based screening of job applications and stuff like that.
In this example, we see very well that feedback loops allow for a new type of power. Power that is characteristic of modern forms of AI. I would call this power to control. Many authors cautioned against such type of power to control, for example, Norbert Wiener. or Gilles Deleuze in his Postscriptum on the Societies of Control, or more recent Catherine Hale with her critique of cybernetics. I'm going to quote, give you one quote from Norbert Wiener, who after the 50s and until the 80s has talked about feedback loops leading to new forms of power and control. Here, the keyword is machine à gouverner. This machine à gouverner is not frightening because of any danger that its real danger is that should machine, though helpless by themselves, may be used by human beings or block of human beings to increase their control over the rest of the human race, or that political leaders may attempt to control their populations. So this is a very good prediction of what we are seeing. And it speaks to doomsday critiques of AI. These are saying that AI is going to put us into feedback loops and structures that make us exposed to powers of control, but powers of control induced by people. So by people who create these machines. So this leads us to power of AI systems and hand powers of control. This is structured in three dimensions: manipulation, discrimination, and exploitation. Let me first start with manipulation and discrimination, which I'm going to treat together. Both are based on prediction. The close capturing of human behavior is capable to compare people to each other, to classify people, and to predict what they might do in the future. If I have data on 5 billion people, I have the capability to predict. It's inherent in AI, database AI. Its capability to predict is characteristic of it. I can then predict a bunch of things, not only whether they're diabetic, I can also talk about their sexual identity, substance abuse, credit. These are then all classifications that are that discrimination can be based on. Other things are psychometric approaches or psychometric measurements based on such data, or just pure sentiment. Hence, data-based cybernetic AI systems are able to predict. It is inherent to these systems. You see the upper block that corresponds to discrimination, and the lower block that corresponds to manipulative uses of political manipulative downstream uses of such predictions. Let's take as example Spotify. What you're hearing right now is used to predict what you're doing, whether you're cooking, relaxing, or working out. Other things that can be predicted is how the user feels. Are they happy right now? Are they lonely? So one thing that's possible is to exploit current sentiment and current user affective state. Hence, the predictive measurement of users is inherent in cybernetic AI systems.
Führt das ganz auf diesen dritten Block
And this leads us to the third block after discrimination manipulation, which is exploitation. The powers of control inherent in AI at least do three things. One are vulnerabilities, psychological vulnerabilities or social vulnerabilities. The second part is an exploitation of data and usage behavior. And third, an exploitation of socioeconomic gradients. So differences usage of differences in wages and difference in how much it costs to pay people to contribute to data production. Hence, in some sense, there is a big systemic feedback loop based on a socioeconomic gradient in our globalized world that is exploited in this data production. So we are in the sustainability track of the Congress. So we should talk a bit about sustainability. So I first talked about powers of control and the implications for to power of AI. So how does this lead to sustainability? In the hyped term sustainability, it does not only necessarily refer to the material consequences or the consequences on energy, for example. But in sustainability, the broad umbrella, as depicted here with the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, there are many more markers or representatives of sustainability. There are at least seven of them that have clearly a social component that are socially sustainable. I highlighted them here. Typically, one says that sustainability is environmental, social, and governance. Let's start with goal number one, and no poverty. In the literature, it has been thoroughly discussed that AI will lead to redistribution from poor to rich, also from the global south to the global north. That it will lead to more poverty among the vulnerable, that there might be more exploitation of groups that are less well-resourced. AI has been described as being extractivist in this book by Kate Crawford. It is said that AI is based on exploitation of resources of people and of data. I'm mostly based on the exploitation of people and data, but there is also a component, a material effect, a direct material effect in the relation to the resources that are needed to train. Other contributions to this discussion are connecting our discussion of AI to colonial debates in earlier times. And one notion that is used here is that expropriation of data contributors, for example, is mentioned in relationship to this colonial AI connection. One study considers the effect of automation on equality as well, and here it is said that vulnerable groups are becoming more vulnerable, as this book by Binaggio Eubanks discusses. Cathy O'Neill in Weapons of Math Destruction also relates this to access broadly to education, but also to jobs and labor. Finally, one book is Uberland, that talks, for example, about their workers in Amazon fulfillment center. Here it is. Here one image that is powerful is that people are the robot arms of an all-powerful machine. And that here, feedback loops encompass people. The next two are gender equality and reduction of inequality. This relates to Catherine D'Ignazio's and Lauren F. Klein's data feminism and Safia Noble's algorithms of oppression. Both highlight inequalities that are inherent in algorithmic technologies. Noble's book highlights impacts on race of this discussion. Neocolonial and racist aspects of this technology are highlighted in the last two books that I'm putting on this slide. Hence, the feedback loop exploitation logic has inherent connections to several of the dimensions that I've presented to you. The last goal that I'm presenting to you today is peace, justice, and strong institutions. One relevant book here is Christopher Wiley's Mindfuck. It claims that we should be worried about the effectiveness of our democratic institutions, and that disinformation might be aggravated by the availability of ChatGPT, and that we might see more challenging situations like Cambridge Analytica coming up. One thing we see is that all these seven SDGs are more challenged by the existence of AI than that their achievement is made easier. One other thing we can do is to talk about, to briefly look at the indicators that the UN puts out for the Sustainable Development Goals. I copy a table from the report from 2023. Right, you see color-coded the progress on each of the SDGs. If you only look at the seven social sustainability development goals that I talked about with you, all of these are should concern us. Two of them are green, which are access to mobile networks and increase to internet usage, which, as we see, relates to an earlier part of this talk. To conclude, I would like to add something to the critique of the system that I gave you so far. AI and climate change are two of the big challenges that our societies are facing. And when I'm saying that we should not reduce AI to its use of resources and to reduce it to effectively climate change, but maintain a social component to it, should be is important because we are all contributing data to systems. If we all stopped using the feedback loop-based platforms, we could make an effect for stock values, but we don't. There is a role for our behavior in this. Systemic problems arise as an interaction of many individuals, and also this one is an example. In AI or data that we're producing every day, all of these data are like emissions that are coming out of our combustion engines. One alone does not make a big change, but on a systemic level, there is a big change. Our data allow predictions about other people. There is an externality of our data. Similarly, for training AI models, we need anonymous data. We don't need data on one particular person. This means that neither the GDPR nor the upcoming AI Act will help meaningfully. If you would like to read more from my that I've written about this, you can scan the QR code on the right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for the great talk. We don't have a lot of time for questions. I don't see anyone at the microphones. Do you have any questions from the internet? Yes, we do. There are two questions. First one, I don't understand how advertising analytics discriminates other than that rich people get bad offers, and I don't understand what the talk is aiming for. Is there some kind of implicit call to action?
So,
advertising analytics is discriminating because the platforms that build the targeting algorithms are using these algorithms to create predictions. If certain users, even those that don't see any ads, have a specific disease, or if they're interested in things like extracurricular lessons, and all of this information can be used, for instance, by the insurance industry to sell services, to create scorings, to discriminate people. So the decisive thing is that a trained AI model can be sold, and a trained AI model is not personalized data and therefore not subject to data protection laws. And the secondary use of trained AI models is, in my opinion, the greatest model when it comes to regulation of AI. There's a paper under the QR code. Unfortunately, our time is up. Thank you very much, Rainer, and another round of applause.